said. That the Prabhupada very much frequently discusses Mayavadi philosophy and gives the opposition to Vaishnava conception, because people in general are nirvishesha shunyavadi. Prabhupada came, we offer our special obeisances unto our spiritual master, who is a very dear servant of Bhakti Sancha Saraswati, who removed this impersonalism and voidism from the world. He went to the Western countries and preached Gauravani Prachana. He preached the message of Lord Chaitanya. Lord Chaitanya met many Mayavadis, and he preached them. Sarvam Bhattacharya, Prakashana Saraswati, and those discussions are there, how he defeated them. Parinamvad, and all the different theories they have, theory of reflection, Pratibimbavad, and all the things are there. One can study the arguments in Chaitanya Charitamrita. But you'll see, someone like Vrindavan Das Thakur, he has a whole book called Chaitanya Bhagavat, all about the teachings of Lord Chaitanya, and none of those things are there. It's just about pastimes with devotees, how to relate with devotees, chanting the holy name, taking prasadam. Mostly it's Vaishnava behavior, and philosophy of the holy name, and discussions of Haridas Thakur and Brahmins and other things. So you can see the angle of vision, how he's presenting Lord Chaitanya in this way, for the devotees and relatives of the devotees. But Prabhupada, realizing that the world is full of Mayavadi philosophy, realized that this should be discussed over and over again, and not avoid it or not be afraid to discuss it or understand it, because it's actually an illusory philosophy propagated by Shankaracharya under the order of Krishna. Lord Shiva was asked to come as Shankaracharya and mislead people and confuse people that are inclined that way, so they have a philosophy they can live by, which is impersonal, because the inclination is that way. But those who have some personal touch, they will not be very much attracted. But you should understand it nevertheless. Because you see, I mean, how many times do you see the word Mayavadi? Thousands of times. Like you type in on the computer Mayavadi in the folio, it's 47,000. Tells you how many times the word is mentioned, all probably 55,000 times or something. That's a lot. So tomorrow we'll have a test on, or we already know it, but we'll have a test on this group. And you can write out 214. There's 214. You want to. Matcha Sparashastra Kaunteya Kitoshna Sukadukada Agama Paino Nityas Kamsakitya Swabharata. Translation. O son of Kunti, the non-permanent appearance of happiness and distress and the disappearance in due course are like the appearance and disappearance of winter and summer seasons. They arise from sense perception, or sign of Bharat. One must learn to tolerate them without being disturbed. Srila Prabhupada's purport. In the proper discharge of duty, one has to learn to tolerate non-permanent appearances and disappearances of happiness and distress. According to Vedic injunction, one has to take his bath early in the morning, even during the month of Maghs, January and February. It is very cold at that time, but in spite of that, a man who abides by the religious principles does not hesitate to take his bath. Similarly, a woman does not hesitate to cook in the kitchen in the months of May and June, the hottest part of the summer season. One has to execute his duty in spite of climatic inconveniences. Similarly, to fight is a religious principle of the Kshatriyas. And although one has to fight with some friend or relative, one should not deviate from his prescribed duties. One has to follow the prescribed rules and regulations of religious principles in order to rise up to the platform of knowledge. Because by knowledge and devotion, one can liberate himself from the clutches of Maya, illusion. The two different names of address given to Arjuna are also significant. To address him as Kaunteya signifies his great blood relations from his mother's side, and to address him as Bharata signifies his greatness from his father's side. From both sides, he is supposed to have a great heritage. A great heritage brings responsibility in the matter of proper discharge of duties. Therefore, he cannot avoid fighting. So, Krishna's using psychology and philosophy, practical philosophy, not imaginative philosophy, very practical and logical philosophy, and also psychology of reminding Arjuna that remember who you are, remember you're a descendant of Bharat, because his father is Pandu. But his great 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 grandfather was Bharat, mother is Kunti, and they're coming from great family lines, so he's in that family, so he has to live up to the family tradition. The family tradition is great, responsible, valorous, heroic Kshatriyas that always perform their duty and never failed in the performance of their duty. So he should be reminded, remember your grandfather. In other words, what would they think of you? What would your ancestors think of you if you were, if they saw you now? If your great grandfather saw you behaving like this, wouldn't you be embarrassed? Or your mother? So he's reminded by those names the father mentioned. And then these are experiences that every person has, even cold, happiness, and distress. They must be tolerated because they're temporary. For the inconveniences of climate or the temporary inconveniences that come in our life or in the performance of our duty, they should be tolerated without giving up our duty, whatever our duty is. In our cases, it's not so difficult to take baths in the winter. We live indoors, don't take baths in the sacred river or something. But still, our duty as devotees or as Brahmins or as devotees, our duty is to serve the Lord and carry out the orders of our spiritual master. Those are the rules and regulations that we have given to us according to our position. And by following those rules and regulations, which means the orders of the spiritual master, Prabhupada mentions in the purport that Arjuna had a certain set of rules and regulations he was supposed to follow. And those rules and regulations are laid down in the Vedic Shastras for the Varnas. But he was in the Kshatriya Varna, so the rules and regulations, you have to fight on the principles, and regardless of the inconvenience or who may be opposing you, even your teachers, Dronacharya, or your elderly grandfather, Bhishma, it doesn't matter what your family relationships are, if they become opposed to Dharma, if they become opposed to religion, then you have a duty to fight. And by performing your prescribed duties and following regulations, then you will receive knowledge. Because duties are given ultimately by God. Because God has given the shastras and given the rules of the shastras. The duties means the orders. The orders means the laws, the rules, the laws of God. And follow the laws of God are the duties, the prescribed duties for your position, because Krishna has given the varnas and the ashramas and all the rules. He's designed them and made them. When you do that, it pleases the Lord, because everything is personal. When you please the Lord by your behavior, then he reciprocates from within the heart by giving you knowledge to understand your ultimate identity and your eternal connection with the Lord and your eternal identity as the Lord's eternal loving servant. So that knowledge comes from properly performing one's duties. As Prabhupada mentioned, if you follow your prescribed rules and regulations of religious principles, you'll rise to the platform of knowledge. The knowledge is important to get liberated from this world, but not only knowledge, but knowledge and devotion, at least for the ultimate liberation. You can have some temporary liberation just again. Of course, this whole section here from chapter 2, from verse 11 to 30, which is an outline given, it's called Jnana Yoga. This section is called Jnana Yoga because it actually gives knowledge. Jnanis will study this, the nature of the body and the soul. What is the difference between the body and the soul? Jnani understands that. what is Brahman, and what is matter, and what is spirit. Aham Brahmasmi, I am Brahman, I am spirit. So this is jnana. In this section, all these verses are very important to understand our identity, our substantial identity as eternal spirit souls. This whole section, verse 211 through 230, they're often referred to as a shelter for a conquering illusion. If we find ourselves lamenting over the bodily situation, a near relative dies, or 10 dies, and we become a little bewildered by the loss of their body or whatever. By reading this section, verse 211 through 230, then we get some comfort or pacify our mind a little bit, and kind of again wake up to the understanding how the soul is eternal, and to tolerate that, and soul is never destroyed, and all the so many verses we'll hear. So here, this is just beginning to explain, as we've already explained already in previous verses, if you're passing from body to, really going from one body to the other, you're changing bodies throughout this life. When in death you got another body, you don't be bewildered by that. So why be bewildered if they change the body? Then Jesus has an old body, I get a young or new body. If he dies in the battlefield, I go to heaven and get a wonderful celestial body by upholding his Dharmic principles. If he dies in knowing me, he'll come to me, get a spiritual body. Either way, he'll get a new body. An improvement, an improvement for him. He's a pious king, he's following religious principles, just to die as a religious kshatriya, or as a kshatriya and fighting in the way of heavenly planet. He remember God, and of course, to get liberation. Now, here he's saying that yes, you may feel some inconvenience or some disturbance in your mind, but this is the philosophy. First thing I think the philosophy. That you're changing bodies from boy abuse to old age, and you're going to another body. Now you understand this philosophy, now your response to this, your performing a duty, is you should just tolerate. Just tolerate the disturbance in your mind and carry on with your duty. So, how that applies to us is that we have our rules and regulations that we have to follow. We're not kshatriyas or whatever, but we're devotees, and we have certain rules and regulations. We rise early in the morning, take bath, and cold bath, and then attend Mangalarti, Sand Japa, Tulsi Puja. So maybe sometimes it's difficult in the winter time, for example, to get up early in the morning. It's difficult, it's very cold in Vrindavan. And to go to the temple, sometimes it's bitter cold outside. You have to go to the temple, you have to go some distance to the temple. We have to tolerate that. And then by doing that, by tolerating that, well, this toleration is required. The only thing you have to tolerate is the prisons of the mind. And because the body really has no force. The force comes from the mind. So it seems the mind is disconnected from the body, but you don't even feel the body. So pleasure and pain is really felt in the mind. Difficulty is felt in the mind, not in the body. Like they say, you can do whatever you set your mind to. If you set your mind to it, if your mind is set to it, then you can do it. The body can do phenomenal things. You can walk for 50 miles. When we were kids, we were 16, we had this idea to walk 50 miles because we get a special award from the President of America. It was like a fitness thing. Everybody was unfit in America, so anybody who walked 50 miles in one day got a special letter from the president or a phone call or something like that. Got a medal and stuff. So we 50 miles is about 80 kilometers. 80 kilometers is 48 miles. That's 82 kilometers. For myself and see, can you do that in one day? Walk 82 kilometers? You walk around Govardhan Hill? Govardhan Hill is how many kilometers? 21. 4 Govardhan Hill. We were in high school. No, I think we were in grammar school. So we were about 14, I think. 14. We left early in the morning. We went from our place, our village, to the capital of our state, was about 50 miles. So we walked. What? Continuous, yeah. Not that. One day. So we left in the morning around 4 or 3:30 or something. And we went to the state police barracks. It's like little police and the state police, like big time. They go all over the place. And little police in the local village and the state police, they go out on big freeways and motorways and stuff. So we went to the barracks and we called up the newspapers and said, you know, we're going to do this, and they had these big coverage and everything. Then we walked there and we got to the police station. We didn't get there until pretty late. It was, I don't know, it was about 9 o'clock at night or something. Pretty long, it took us a while. Didn't realize how long it was. And then we got there and then they were taking dinner or something. So they all grew there. They were all happy. We were little kids, but we were big policemen. And then they had a big dinner for us and everything, and then we stayed overnight, and then next night we took the bus back home. So, we have to tolerate. What does that have to do with fighting in a battlefield? Anyway, somehow, sometimes Charlie would tell different stories when he was out. When I was a kid, I used to ride my bicycle through Dalhousie Square. When I was 5 years old, I'd ride through Dalhousie Square in Calcutta and go to the Maidan and go to Queen Victoria's place. And Stephen Cavity sometimes talk about things like that. So I don't know. How do I start talking about that? What? No, but why did I start talking about that? We're not to tolerate. So once we did this, we walked like this. And so all that's like this. What do we set our mind to? I think the body has no senses. The body has senses. I have no real feelings. As not the feelings are registered in the mind. Happiness, that's what I'm saying. Happiness and distress is in the mind. As soon as I give you a shot of Novocaine or something, they give me a sense of it, it fills your mind with this drug, and you can't feel it. They're just cutting you up like anything, right? You don't feel any happiness and distress. And then you look in your head and saw a big hole in your head. And you know, then you say, wow. So the body is disconnected from the mind. You follow it? The body disconnects from the mind. The body on its own does not register happiness and distress. Although we use the body, it's probably happiness and distress. But the body, the happiness and distress is in the mind. It's felt in the mind. Just like it's like someone who's, say, for sex enjoyment. So those parts of the body that we put Novocaine there, and numb those parts, you know, with drugs, you wouldn't feel anything. Because there's a pleasure coating, as Prabhupada mentions in the Gita and the Bhagavatam, there's a pleasure coating on the genitals of the man and woman, so they feel some pleasure. But if the Novocaine is put there in those nerves, which connect those, the nerves connect the parts of the body are connected to the mind by the nerve endings. So if all those nerves are filled with drugs, which starts thick at the brain, you can't feel it. You're like, what's going on? There's nothing. You know, the pleasure, so the pleasure sensation is in the mind. That's the whole Buddhist conception. It's, all play is just in the mind. Why annihilate the body? Because there's nothing in the body anyway. So he's saying that, so the point is, when we did that walk, we had to tolerate. Because we were really, we kept thinking, how far have we gone? We just had a map. We didn't have anything to count our feet. We just had a map. We knew certain villages were 70 miles. When we got to one village, and towards the end, it seemed like we kept wanting to quit. Everyone, there's four of us. And actually, one quit. I think one person just down his tight tone or something. Forgetting what the heck. But we stayed, and it was really tough because the mind's really reacting. And but it's for the body. I mean, what I'm saying is the body can do. Okay. The point I'm making is that the body can do whatever you set your mind to. That's the whole point of the story. The body can do whatever you set your mind to. So we set our minds to the idea that we want to walk 50, or what we said, 80 kilometers. And the body said, okay, let's go, and it did it. Ordinarily, your body would say, oh, it's too much. So this is the point. So Arjuna, he has his mind, this happiness and distress is registered in the mind. So when the mind is improperly situated, you can undergo all kinds of distress. And there's many examples which we've all seen in our life. And the classic one is an athlete. An athlete, I don't know about your country, but soccer maybe or whatever, but in America they play football. It's a very dangerous sport. So they tackle each other and they throw each other on the ground and stuff and chase after this little ball, football. So what happens sometimes is a person breaks his leg or breaks his knee in the last quarter, the last 15 minutes of the game. His knee is actually broken, completely destroyed. But his mind is so much set on victory. His mind is completely set on victory that I have to carry this ball across this field to this other side of the field and win victory for my team. Which means I win the Olympics or win the prize or whatever. So then he runs that distance, and when the game is over, and they win. And then he's lying there, when his mind returns to his body and away from his goal, then he can't tolerate anymore. But when his mind is set on his goal, then he can tolerate. So much difficult. It's too soon. Deathly pain. His knee is completely cartilage is all ripped and destroyed and twisted, and his whole knee is broken. But yet in that condition, he ran for 15 minutes all around the football field. Like a madman, and we're tolerating out of madness to achieve his goal. He was tolerating out of the madness to achieve his mundane goal. He tolerates so much pain, so much distress, so much dukkha. And then the game's over, and he's lying there, ah! And then the doctor goes, oh, what happened? Why did you tell me? I'll tell you later. It was like that for 15 minutes. It's just a real tiny thing. You break a card or something, and so your mind is absorbed. If someone, just for example, someone deeply writing a letter, they're reading or something in their room, they're really concentrating, their friend comes in and says, hello. And ordinarily, they would understand and hear that. And say, Kapila! Oh, what? I mean, I called you 3 times, and you hear me? Oh, I didn't even know. Because sometimes your mind is so absorbed, you don't even perceive the sense input. And because your mind is captivated by some reading or some writing or something, or you're working on some model or doing something. And you know, they say, didn't you hear me? I called you 5 times. You know? I said, oh yeah, I heard it last time. And as you get into, so the mind is very powerful too. So this same mind is where this distress is registered, or this happiness is registered. So we have to tolerate those things and always perform our duty. We set our mind to our duty. And in Arjuna's case, he should have set his mind to the shooting of arrows and the performing his sexual functions, and then tolerate any kind of inconveniences produced by the body. Because once your mind is set on your goal, then you can tolerate any inconveniences of the body. So his mind, the problem with Arjuna, his mind was not set on the goal. His mind was, that's why Krishna's using this very practical philosophy. So this comes and goes in the mind. This happiness and distress comes in the mind. So your mind is not set. Your mind is not set on your duty. Your mind is not set on your goal, your function as a kshatriya. Your mind has become, that's what he said, you're lamenting for what is not worthy of lamenting. That's lamentations in the mind. You're lamenting for what is not worthy of lamenting and all these things. Don't give us such petty weakness of the heart. And arise, set your mind on your duty. So once the mind is set on a particular goal, then you can tolerate, you won't be deviated by any lamentation or any changes of climate or any difficulties in the body. As it may be a little cold, but my mind is, no, I, your mind is set, no, I must do this. I must go to Mangalore Peak every day, so even in the cold, you bundle up and you go out in the cold and walk to the temple or whatever, or get in the car. So this, and it comes and goes. It just comes and goes. It's very temporary. That is our experience already in life, but sometimes we forget, due to forgetfulness, we think that our present situation is, sometimes we overreact. We overreact to our present situation as if it's everything, or if it, what's happening to me now is everything. You know, my whole existence is what's happening to me now, if it's disturbing to my mind. But we understand the nature of this material world, material nature is always changing. But today I'm stressed out and distressed and unhappy to the fullest extent, and I can't see anything else. But then next week it's a whole different thing. It's just like you have a pain or something, your back hurts or something, or something, you have some pain. It comes and goes, maybe longer time, shorter time. The same with the mind. The mind is very, very fluctuating. As long as the mind is influenced by the modes of nature, it's very fluctuating. That's why we have to perform a duty. According to the mode of nature we're in, we're assigned a particular varna and ashram. So, in that varna and ashram, according to the mode of nature that we're assigned in, we have rules and regulations. And by following those rules and regulations, we transcend. We attain knowledge by which we can transcend that mode and come to the mode of goodness, and then ultimately pure goodness. And pure goodness, we're never disturbed. We're never disturbed by happiness and distress. Is on the transcendental platform. So Prabhupada, in our movement, he wanted everybody to act as a brahmana, everyone to become brahmanas, everyone to come to this platform of sattva-guna. That's the teachings of Bhagavad Gita, to come to the platform of sattva-guna, and come to the platform from sattva-guna, you can stand to Krishna, and serve Krishna, and you become brahma-dutta. So right now, Arjuna is in Rajagun and Tamagun, lamenting and subject to duality and illusion. The Krishna sounds say, look, this illusion is temporary, it's coming and going. Don't give up your duty, because if you give up your duty and stop following the rules and regulations that are given to you, then you'll become influenced by ignorance. And ignorance will lose all sight of your identity or your function or your purpose or the goal of life. But if you somehow just push away you just ignore the mind by setting your mind on your duty, setting your mind on your duty and setting your mind on the rules and regulations, or setting your mind on the orders of spiritual master, and then you can tolerate. Because by doing that, you'll get knowledge by which you can transcend the dualities of this body and mind and recognize them for what they are. It's just a temporary duality that's coming. Oh, now my mind is distressed. It's not me. Anyway, my mind's distressed, let me do my duty. My mind's peaceful, let me do my duty. My duty is to serve Krishna. Our duty is to serve Krishna. Not to shoot arrows, exactly. Oh, my mind's giving me so much distress, I don't want to do anything. Anyway, let me do my duty anyway. I have so many things I have to do. So just summer rounds and study Bhagavatam, whatever we have to do, different things. So let me set my mind on my service, which are my rules and regulations. And by setting my mind on my service, then I'll be pleasing to Krishna, because he's giving me that service. And when Krishna's pleased, then he'll give me knowledge. When I get knowledge, I can rise above the dualities which are causing me difficulty in my mind, which are distracting me from my duty. This illusion or this so-called distress and happiness. Distress and happiness is using up so much difficulty. When we're peaceful and happy, it's easy to perform our duties to some extent. But if it's too hot, it's too cold, so many different dualities will come in our life, which distract us from our duty. If we surrender to dualities of the illusions of Maya, then we actually lose our footing in Krishna consciousness. We lose our connection with the Lord. We become covered by ignorance or forgetfulness. Do you have a question? You wrote something down, you said? You couldn't find it? Or? Arjuna, Krishna says, "O best among men, Arjuna, the person who is not disturbed by happiness and distress is steady in both, and is certainly eligible for liberation." You know, if you're not affected by the dualities of the mind, because the duality is in the mind, happiness and distress is experienced in the mind, if you're not affected, then you become nistha. You become nistha. And when it's nistha, then you can get ritual and go on to liberation. Those who are seers of the truth have concluded that the non-existent, the material body, there is no endurance. Now the eternal soul, there is no change. This soul is concluded by studying the nature of both. That which pervades the entire body is to know to be indestructible. No one is able to destroy that imperishable soul. And when you kill your bhisma or dronacharya with your arrows, you're not killing anyone. It's just removing your body, but the soul is imperishable. It can't be destroyed. You're not destroying the soul. Daniel 18, the material body of the indestructible, immeasurable, and eternal living entity is sure to come to an end. Therefore, fight, O descendant of Bharata. Your body is going to die today or tomorrow. So, if you're the agent of that and a ridiculous fight, then no problem. But the soul is indestructible, immeasurable, and eternal. Then he says, neither he who thinks the living entity the slayer, nor he who thinks the slain is in knowledge. For the self slays not, nor is slain. So, the soul is not, as he said it, the living entity is a slayer. In other words, the living entity is, of course, in his case, the self, the soul, can't be killed, and the body is. The soul is not the living entity is not the slayer. The soul is not killing. Probably this mentions in the purport that if you killing without authority is abominable. If you murder someone, you're punished by the state. But if you're engaged, Arjuna probably is engaged in killing for principle of religion, so it's not whimsical. So he's, Arjuna is killing the body, not the soul. And then he says that in verse 20, that's the one we want to learn. You know that one? So that's more on the same point. For the soul, there is neither birth nor death of any kind. He has not come into being. He does not come into being. I will not come into being. He is unborn, eternal, ever existing, and primeval. Do you have a different translation? He is not slain, the body is slain. There is a new translation. The older one is different. The old Gita. Yeah. His soul is neither birth nor death. His soul is neither birth nor death. Having one thing together ceased to be. Yeah, that's how Prabhupada says. For the soul there is neither birth nor death, nor having one skin, nor having one skin that the other ceased to be. He is unborn, eternal, ever existing, primeval. The middle part of that, that's different. Does not come into being. That's all. He has not come into being, does not come into being, and will not come into being. Okay. I don't know. There's some reason. We have to learn that one. Chapter 2, verse 20. Najayate Muyate Va Kodatya Nayam Bhutva Bhavita Va Nabhuya Ajo Nitya Shastato Yam Puranho Nahanyate Hanyamane Sarire. For the soul there is neither birth nor death at any time. He has not come into being, does not come into being, and will not come into being. He is unborn, eternal, ever existing in primeval. He is not slain, the body is slain. So forth. Qualitatively, qualitatively, the small atomic fragmental part of the Supreme Spirit is one with the Supreme. He undergoes no changes like the body. Sometimes the soul is called the steady or kuta sta. The body is subject to six kinds of transformation. It takes its birth from the womb of its mother's body, remains for some time, grows, produces some effect, gradually dwindles, and at last vanishes into oblivion. The soul, however, does not go through such changes. The soul is not born, but because he takes on a material body, the body takes its birth. The soul does not take birth there. The soul does not die. Anything which has birth also has death. And because the soul has no birth, he therefore has no past, present, or future. He is eternal, ever existing in primeval. That is, there is no trace in history of his coming into being. Under the impression of the body, we seek the history of birth, etc., of the soul. The soul does not at any time become old, as the body does. The so-called old man, therefore, feels himself to be in the same spirit as in his childhood or youth. The changes of the body do not affect the soul. The soul does not deteriorate like a tree or anything material. The soul has no byproducts either. The byproducts of the body, namely children, are also different individual souls, and owing to the body, they appear as children of a particular man. The body develops because of the soul's presence. The soul has neither offshoots nor change. Therefore, the soul is free from the six changes of the body. In the Kapila Upanishad 1-18, we also find a similar passage with these. Najayate Muyate Va Vipaschim Sayam Kutaschim Na Abhu Vakaschit Ajo Nitya Shastato Yam Purano Nahanyate Hanyamane Sarire. The meaning and purport of this verse is the same as in the Bhagavad Gita. But here, in this verse, there is one special word, Vipaschit, which means learned or with knowledge, like Vipura. The soul is full of knowledge, and always full with consciousness. Therefore, consciousness is the symptom of the soul. Even if one does not find the soul within the heart, where he is situated, one can still understand the presence of the soul simply by the presence of consciousness. Sometimes we do not find the sun in the sky owing to clouds or for some other reason, but the light of the sun is always there, and we are convinced that it is therefore daytime. As soon as there is a little light in the sky early in the morning, we can understand that the sun is in the sky. Similarly, since there is some consciousness in all bodies, whether man or animal, we can understand the presence of the soul. This consciousness of the soul, however, is different from the consciousness of the Supreme, because the Supreme Consciousness is all knowledge, past, present, and future. The consciousness of the individual soul is prone to be forgetful. When he is forgetful of his real nature, he obtains education and enlightenment from the superior lessons of Krishna. But Krishna is not like the forgetful soul. If so, the teachings of Krishna's teachings of Bhagavad Gita would be useless. There are two kinds of souls, namely the minute particle soul, Anu Atma, and the super soul, Vibhu Atma. This is confirmed in the Tatra Upanishad 1.2.20 in this way. Anoriyan Mahato Mahiyan Atmasyanto Mahito Mahito Guhayam Samatakai Pastiti Vita Soko Tapu Pushadhan Ahimana Matmana. Both Upanamatma and Jivatma are situated on the same tree of the body, within the same heart of the living being, and only one who has become free from all material desires as well as lamentations can, by the grace of the Supreme, understand the glories of the soul. Krishna is the fountainhead of the super soul also, as will be disclosed in the following chapters. And Arjuna is the atomic soul, forgetful of his real nature. Therefore, he requires to be enlightened by Krishna or by his bona fide representative, who is the Master. In this verse, Krishna is explaining to Arjuna, he's defining the nature of the soul in many different ways, in all different aspects. Because Arjuna is lamenting over the bodies of his relatives, so he's really giving all different definitions, one by one, one word by one word. Najayate, niyate, vakadakshin. He's not going to slay anyone, as we said in the previous verse. The soul, when he thinks that the soul is slain, he says that the soul is not the slayer, nor he who thinks that the slain is in knowledge. So the soul can never be slain. So he starts out this way by saying the soul is never born. Because it's never born, only something that is born can die. This world, death happens to those that are alive. Living means someone took birth. The body is living, the body dies. But the soul is living, it's the real life. But it never takes birth. So if one takes birth, then death is certain. So for the soul, there is neither birth nor death. Jayate, the soul is never born, and something is never born, can never die. So Muyate, there's no Jayate, no Muyate. And he says, Nayam Bhutva, then he says, Bhutva. But that's what means at any time. Not now was the soul ever born, not in the future will it ever be born, not in the past was it ever born, it'll never die. But that's at any time. Bhutva, and then Bhavita, and Bhuya. So these words mean Bhutva, Bhavita, and Bhuya. This means that the soul is not coming to being. It does not come into being, it will not come into being. In other words, the soul never becomes something, it already is. It already exists like it is. He never became something in the past, he's not becoming something now, he's not becoming something in the future. He's unchangeable. He's always eternally existing in his position. But sometimes he's covered by a material body and he seems to be separated from the Lord. And sometimes when he becomes free from the material body, then he starts to unite again with the Lord in the spiritual world. Then again, basically he's repeating some, well, he says, Najayate, Niyate, which means he's not born. Then he says, Ajo, Najayate, what is the difference between Ajo and Najayate? Najayate, what is Najayate means? Not birth, not born. Ajo means what? Ajanma. Without Janma, what is it? So he's repeating himself. He's unborn. But when he's never born, he's eternal. says he's unborn. He's not unborn. The soul is not born. And he said, when were you born? When were you born? Someone says, well, when were you born? When's your birthday? Birthday means that when you were born. And so I, you know, because maybe that'd be someone who'll think you're kind of giving them a hard time or saying, when were you born? I'm always interested. I think you're some kind of crazy person. When were you born? When's your birthday? I've always been. I'm eternal. Oh, okay, well, let me ask another question. What about your body? Oh, the body? Your body eternal? No. Well, when did you say you, what is you? Are you the body? No. We say, this is my body. We often use that description. We say, this is my house. Right? This is my house, my bicycle. This is my body, my leg, my head, my back. Oh, my back. So this is my, but what am I? It is my body. When you describe, it's my house. It's just something outside of yourself. It is my house and my body. So that's outside of you. Well, what are you? What am I? Well, am I my? No, I am something different than my. It is my house and my body and my clothes and my hair and my teeth, my eyes. So what am I? I'm not these things. You're always, when we're describing. What is point to your nose, and what is that? It's my nose, it's my eyes, right? Well, then we say, what am I? Well, and I say, well, point to the eye, and you go, whoa, they don't know where to point.
This reminds
me of this, like, that's good. So we're different than that. So Krishna is trying to emphasize to Arjuna that, look, no one's going to kill. And he's not the body, you're going to, because it's all about, the whole thing is about, his duty is to kill. Katsya means to kill. The word Katsya means to protect, and cut means to hurt. So we have an English word, cut, we got a cut. C-U-T, cut, well it comes from C-K-S-A-T. Cut means, the word Katsya